Number three is to acknowledge your current problems. Okay. One of the reasons why my clients tend to have a lot of confidence, One of the reasons why my clients tend to have a lot of confidence in their own ability to manage their problems, their health and safety and environmental problems, is because they watch themselves struggling with those problems. So you discover, let's say, that somebody claims there's a groundwater contamination problem. You look into it, and you discover, yes, there's a groundwater contamination problem. You look into it some more. It looks even worse than you thought. You finally wrap your arms around the problem. You finish your site characterization. You start trying to solve the problem. You try something. It doesn't work. You try something else. It doesn't work either. You try a third thing. Looks like it might be working. You expand your pilot to field status. You do some more testing. You dot your I's and cross your T's. And somewhere down the road, 3 years later, 6 years later, 20 years later, you know you have the problem licked. And the reason, the main reason you know you have the problem licked is you were there when you didn't have the problem licked. You were there when you didn't know if you were going to be able to solve the problem at all, and you didn't have a clue what you were going to try. Unfortunately, most organizations solve their problems quietly. It wouldn't be fair to say secretly, but quietly. You don't usually want your stakeholders, especially your hostile stakeholders, around while you are flailing, while you are struggling to try to find a way to get this problem solved. So we tend to solve the problem, and then we contact the stakeholders, and we tell them there's no problem. Okay? And by the time we contact the stakeholders, there is no problem because we got it solved. Okay. But they don't believe there's no problem because they weren't there watching while we solved it. Okay. The lesson here is very straightforward but very counterintuitive for most organizations. If you want credit for solving problems, you have to solve them while we watch. In order to solve them while we watch, you have to tell us about them before you solve them and invite us to come watch before you know whether you're even going to be able to solve them. The downside, of course, is if you fail, we see it. The upside is if you succeed, we believe it. If you usually fail, the downside probably is higher than the upside. But if you usually succeed, if you think you have a pretty good record as a mining company for solving your problems, then it is in your interest to have those solutions be credible. And the way you get them to be credible is by inviting your stakeholders, especially your hostile stakeholders, to watch before you've made any progress, while you're still flailing. One model here is athletes. Steroids notwithstanding, if you want credit for breaking the world record for the broad jump, you can't go into a dark gym late at night and then come out and hold a news conference and announce that you have broken the record. If you want credit for breaking the record, you have to jump with the lights on in the gym and with the judges in the gym, and the judges have to include people who don't want you to break the record. I think in some ways a more straightforward model or a less hypothetical role model is the chemical industry's responsible care program. The chemical industry, starting in Canada and then spreading worldwide, has established now for several decades that no chemical company can be approved, can be a member of the trade association unless it has a community advisory panel at every site, or at least at every large site. So there are thousands of chemical industry community advisory panels. Now, many of you have community advisory panels at your sites as well, but the mining industry and the minerals industry have not integrated this into their worldwide, industry-wide functioning nearly as much as the chemical industry has. So their experience is thousands and thousands of community advisory panels, and a very interesting thing happens. In the vast majority of cases, the members of the panel become less hostile. Okay. Almost against their will. It's not because the hostile people quit. It's much more because the hostile people become less hostile. They didn't want to become less hostile, but watching you flail is a confidence-building experience. They get to discover how hard you try. They get to discover how difficult these problems are. They get to discover how much money you spend trying to solve them. These are all things they didn't know. And the process of learning them diminishes their hostility. It does so much in many cases that often community advisory panels become insufficiently hostile. And I think, you know, we discussed this briefly this morning when we talked about what happens when outrage is too low. How do you sustain the structures when outrage is too low? But this is exactly what happens to a lot of chemical industry advisory panels. They start out awful. And I have said to clients, as long as it's awful, you're in good shape. The key moment is when a panel meeting ends and you don't have a headache. Because these things should give you a headache. And if you're having meetings with advisory teams of any sort, with community panels of any sort, and you are not ending the meeting with a headache, that's a danger sign. But that's a danger sign. It means you are getting along better and better and better with the panel, which is good as far as it goes. But if you're getting along with the panel and the people you're not getting along with aren't on the panel, then you have converted the panel from a conduit for outrage into a buffer. Okay? So, you know, you have enough flax already. You know, you have enough PR people already. You don't need to turn this community consultation panel into yet another layer of buffering. You need it as a conduit for outrage. Now, it's a different story if the traditional owners have appointed or elected a group of people and they are, in fact, the decision makers. Then they're not a conduit for outrage. They are the people. You still need contact with other stakeholders, but those folks they weren't selected to be representative. They were selected because they are the leadership structure. But with most community advisory panels, the purpose of those people is to bring to you the outrage of the larger community. And it starts out working fine, and then they stop being outraged enough. And you need to replenish, you need to refresh the membership with newly outraged people. And, you know, obviously some of the existing people may resent that, but it's critically important to do that. But the lesson for this point number three to acknowledge your current problems is that happens. You know, that all these panels typically become, or nearly all these panels, typically become less and less hostile. And you want as many people as possible to have that experience, so it's important to understand what it is about sitting on a panel that diminishes hostility. And I would argue that one of the main things that sitting on the panel accomplishes is the opportunity to watch you flail. So giving as many people and especially hostile people as possible that opportunity is a very big piece of outrage management. Now, there's another reason, actually two more reasons, for telling us about your problems before you solve them. The first reason, and the one I focused on so far, is it makes the solution more credible if I have watched you struggle to solve the problem. The second reason is if I get it, that when you have a problem, you tell us about it promptly. That establishes a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, that when you don't tell me about a problem, it must not be your problem. Those of you who are into logic, this is the logic of the contrapositive. Those of you who are not into logic, that statement does you no good whatever. But I think an example will make the point very clearly. I had a client some years ago, a refinery that decided as part of its outrage management plan that any time anything happened on site that was detectable off site, it might be a flare or a siren, they would call the local police department and tell the desk sergeant. So if a neighbor called and said, "What's going on?" the desk sergeant could say, "Oh yeah, the refinery called, here's the story." In the first 5 months of this policy, the refinery management made 19 calls to the police. None of those calls were a result of their emergency response plan. All 19 calls were a result of this new public affairs plan. And then one day after 5 months, after 19 calls, an acrid odor was wafting through the neighborhood. And scores of people called the police and said, "What's that smell?" And the desk sergeant said, "I don't know, but it can't be the refinery or they would have called." Now, they earned that with 19 technically unnecessary telephone calls. Now, obviously, if it turned out it was the refinery, they would have lost it again. I'm not suggesting that if you tell us about enough problems promptly, you earn the right to lie about one later. You know, kind of like a mulligan in golf. It's not like that. What I am suggesting is that once you set a precedent that when you have a problem, you tell everybody about it, then if you haven't told everybody about something, we start with the assumption that it's probably not your problem. And that's a very valuable presumption, particularly in communities where you're not the only industrial facility, where there are other possible sources of the problem and people are trying to guess who it is. If you tell us when it's you, we're always going to guess it's not you when you don't tell us. And that's of considerable value to you. The third benefit for telling us about problems before you solve them results from the fact that you don't actually solve problems completely. I've been talking as if solving the problem was dichotomous, but it's not. You solve as much of the problem as you can, or in some cases, you solve as much of the problem as you have to. And we all know that the cost of problem solving increases exponentially as we get closer and closer to the solution. So the first 90% of the problem is usually pretty cheap to solve. The next 9% cost more than the first 90%. The next 0.9% cost more than that 9%, and so on until the last molecule of dimethyl meatloaf in the groundwater is infinitely expensive to find and remove. Okay, does that make sense to everybody? Okay. And finally, the third reality that contributes to this is we all know that people discount heavily the part of the solution that you do before they're watching. Okay. So if you solve the cheap 90% of the problem and then tell me about the problem, as far as I'm concerned, the remaining 10% is the problem. And the amount of solution I am going to require is one order of magnitude greater than it would have been if I'd watched the 90% get solved. Okay, so yeah, I mean, Tom Lehrer, an American mathematician and humorist of the 1950s, rewrote the Boy Scout marching song back in the 50s. And one of the things he said that captures this perfectly, he said, "Never do your good deed when there's no one watching you." Okay, and that is, I think, a very big piece of the essence of this third recommendation. You want me watching you, you want your critics watching you before you start solving the problem, so that the cheap part of the problem solving, the less expensive part of the problem solving, is while I watch, and the point at which you and I ultimately agree enough is enough, the remaining little tiny piece of the problem is not serious, will be earlier if I was there to watch the first 90% get solved. So you got three reasons, I think, for sharing the information, telling people about the problem before you solve the problem. Now, that's all I want to say about number three. Are there comments or questions? Yes?
If you talk about having to replenish the outrage of your community members, what about the company representative who is part of that committee constantly having that outrage at them? You kind of tend to switch off after a while. And is there maybe part of that jigsaw the requirement to replenish internally?
That's a super question. If we're replenishing the community members of the advisory team because they're not outraged enough, what about replenishing the company members because they're losing the ability to cope with outrage? It's very exhausting to be responding to outrage all the time, and it might be a good idea to cycle people in and out of that job as well. Do I capture your comment?
Yeah. Without losing relationships, I guess that's the other side of it. You want to maintain the relationships with your community members, but not at the expense of
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the relationships are valuable, and there are people who can do this forever and do it with pleasure, and they apparently have an appetite for outrage and can continue to manage it over the long haul. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there are two lessons there. One is people who are exposed to other people's outrage, people inside the company who are dealing with outrage, this should be seen as an HR issue. This should, you know, I mean, you know, you shouldn't expect somebody to work all day, go to a meeting until midnight, go home and try and get some sleep after being beat up for 7 hours, and show up for work at 8 o'clock the next morning feeling fine. That's too much to expect. So one of the lessons, and the one that you focused on, is cycling people out of that job and bringing new people in because they're likely to burn out. And I would add that, you know, on a more shorter term basis, I would want to give people an opportunity after enduring a hostile meeting. They need a chance to debrief. They need a chance to the psyche word is decaffect. To express how irritating they found that yesterday. You don't want them to express those feelings at the community. So you need to give them an internal opportunity to say how unpleasant it was last night. That will help them last longer, I think, in the job. But I agree with you. People have to be cycled out.